Well, I wasn't sure how to start, so I thought I'd try to start with something to make you laugh, because I knew what I was going to be following. This is at least laughable. John Howard said this week that working families in Australia have never been better off. Now, okay, that does make you angry. But unfortunately for him, Prue Goward, one of his proteges, she stood for election in New South Wales, and at virtually at the same time as Howard was making this proclamation, she was talking to the press about voter dissatisfaction. And so when Howard turned his radio on that night, he heard her declaring, they, the voters, were telling me that their ship loadings were being cut and their incomes are going down. And that's precisely why the IR laws, the industrial relations laws, were the first on a list of issues for people in the New South Wales elections, even though that government really isn't going to do anything much about them. But they said that they would defend workers from the IR laws. Now, the point isn't just to slag off at John Howard, but it is to draw out, which I think has started to become very clear from listening to the other two speakers, the similar picture in every country around the world. You know, there's details in some countries, the oppression and the poverty is much worse, but particularly in the developed world, I think the picture is very similar. Here, as in the other developed countries, the image in the press is of this economy that is going so well. And it actually impacts on people. That the number of times I've had people saying that workers are too well off in Australia, they've got mortgages, they've got too many cars, you know, they have holidays. Actually, in Australia, this image relies on the lifestyle of 10, perhaps 15, at the most 20% of people in Australia. The top 10% of people since 1998 have had an income, their income in real terms has gone up 13.8%. You come to the bottom 10% and their incomes have increased by barely 1%. And then if you take into account the regressive GST, the increased costs of health and education, actually that 1% is eaten away much more rapidly for people than the, you know, nearly 14% to the top. The Salvation Army, hardly raving radicals, are complaining that they think that over 2 million people in Australia are living under the poverty line. 12.5% of children are living under the poverty line set by UNICEF. And I can assure you, these poverty lines, you have to be in dire straits to be beneath them. And that's without even mentioning what everyone in this room knows about the conditions of the Indigenous population of Australia. The absolute oppression, the destruction of culture, again we're seeing the beginnings of another stolen generation because so many state departments are taking children away from their families, you know, rather than admit that the child abuse and the substance abuse in the communities is caused by the oppression, the dispossession and the ongoing structural racism that they live with every day. And so, you know, I could talk for a whole 20 minutes about all of that, but people know the facts, I'm sure. But we need to remind ourselves of them. But it's not just the consequences of the neoliberal economic attacks. In every country of the world, we live under the shadow of the war on terror. And, you know, the consequences of that are becoming more and more obvious. Apart from the fact that defence spending everywhere is skyrocketing, you know, America is, you know, miles ahead, but in Australia, defence spending has gone up now every year since the year 2000, while we see the spending on health, education, welfare, all the things that people need are being cut. We see the Australian troops being used, you know, in this atmosphere as basically an army of occupation in East Timor so that they can, the capitalists in Australia can steal the oil. We see the recolonisation of Papua New Guinea and the Solomons and the troops being used to put down a democracy movement some months ago in Tonga. So we need to remind ourselves this is not just about a superpower of the United States. We live in a middling imperialist power that wants to carry out similar imperialist aggression in the region where we live, apart from the fact that they have the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. And out of the war on terror, we see, you know, the anti-Muslim racism, which we live with day in and day out in all of the major countries. But associated with that, we are seeing an erosion of human rights, a whole range of attitudes that really were established to some extent through the struggles of the past and all the rest of it, certain rights that people should have. And they're being whittled away in a whole range of ways. I heard a discussion on the radio a couple of weeks ago, I think it's that long ago, when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confessed to all those supposed crimes, you know, the terrorist crime, one of which the Americans tried to hush up because there's actually someone on death row for one of the things that he's confessed to. Anyway, that's bad enough. But this discussion, some expert was on, they were talking about, did he commit this one, perhaps that one, he couldn't have done that one, he wasn't in that country then, he was in somewhere else, you know. And then someone says, well, he's probably insane because he's been in the CIA jails for 5 years. And it's just like, oh, ho-hum, people go insane in CIA jails, and they just continued discussing whether he may or may not have committed this list of atrocities that he's confessed to. And then a couple of days ago, with all the, you know, news about David Hicks, I had the same feeling of chill through my bones that you think that this is the way human rights are talked about today. An academic from the University of New South Wales Law Department commented that, well, David Hicks has spent 5 years in Guantanamo, which may or may not have involved mistreatment. So it's established. You know, the treatment in Guantanamo is not mistreatment. Something worse has to happen. And so this has consequences. How many people in the room know that there are 22 young Muslim men in Australia being held under conditions that are quite similar to Guantanamo? How many people know? Some do, because we, you know, follow these things and we've been involved in the campaign around David Hicks, and it comes up in the campaign. What is being said about these 22 young men that are kept shackled in their rooms, their cells, 16 to 22 hours a day? That they are denied their religious rights. They're not allowed to pray together because they're Muslim. They have no business, you know, where they can contact their families. What have they been accused of? Of belonging to a non-existent organisation. And they're not accused of doing anything. They're accused of discussing things. The things they may have talked about. And I can tell you some of the things we recorded talking about. We could all be in the same situation because we discuss similar things, you know, when we're drunk and, you know, have too many gins. I'm sorry, that seems like a joke, but it isn't a joke. This means that attitudes and rights that appear to have been established as part of liberal democracy are being whittled away so that people can make these comments in the most cold-blooded way and no one even, the interviewers, that no one says, come on here, we're supposed to be talking about human beings that should have some rights. Now, so what is the alternative? And if we go through the alternative as well, you begin to get a picture, I think, that is similar in country after country from the first two presentations. You know, we have all these experts that want to talk and nitpick about this government and that government, and perhaps we could unpick this little thing and we might be able to change the law here or there. We have people who say, oh, we need more people to be educated. I even encountered someone recently that said, oh, you know, the workers in Western Sydney, they wouldn't know what to do. A student told me that in her class, someone said, the lower classes, they don't have political ideas. Well, the educated people in the elite universities, they're teaching over here at Melbourne University in a course on the Middle East that the problem in the Middle East, you might all think you know what the problem is, the United States comes to mind, all the meddling and the other imperialist powers have meddled there for the last century. Actually, it's the divisions between Sunnis and Shiites. And this is the line of this whole, you know, education that students are receiving. And so, you know, I think that, like the other countries, we can see that there's the official picture of everything. There's what's said by the educated, respectable people. Filth, basically. Scum. The scum rises to the top. And actually, it's to the bottom where we have to look because in every country, under these conditions, people's ideas are moving to the left and people are willing to fight. What is missing are organisations to make the most of that willingness to fight. Here in Australia, 70% of people think that big business has too much power. Only 27.9% of people say that they would prefer tax cuts to government spending. And Peter Costello was still on the news this morning saying that we've got to give tax cuts because that's what everybody wants. You know, completely out of touch. So it's great to see John Howard on the back foot. We all want to see him go. But what is the alternative? Is there an alternative through the Parliament? Think of the Labor Party. Within about 2 days this week, they ditched public ownership of Telstra, Aboriginal rights. They're going to open more uranium mining, all these things that Kevin Rudd is going to be pushing at the upcoming conference. Kevin Rudd cannot get the word through his mouth, we will defend workers' living standards, let alone say we will increase workers' living standards. All he can say is we're going to have responsible economic policies and invoke the image of the Hawke Keating Labor government in the 1980s, which presided over the biggest redistribution of wealth from the poorest to the richest in Australian history. Now, you might think that the Greens are something of an alternative, and given them their due, they've taken a stand against the war, they've taken a stand against David Hicks. We stand with them again and again. I was involved in a campaign for refugee rights with many of them. But again, that having our eye on Parliament is so disorienting. Where are the Greens when it comes to the fight in the union movement to get a decent campaign going? When we used to go to delegates' meetings last year, everywhere, union delegates wanted the kinds of things that John said, you know, general strike. We didn't have a chance for general strike, but they put their hand up and voted for a general strike in Victoria to defeat the IR laws. And just like in France, who could make it happen? The Greens don't even intervene in the debate. You know, we're a tiny little organisation, and we had members as delegates that could get up and be part of this argument and debate it. But we could not make the general strike happen. We can't push the union officials aside and build on the sentiment that is there to fight. And we saw the hundreds of thousands coming out, you know, again and again to show that people want to fight, and what's the union official bureaucracy turned it into? An election campaign for that. They've actually changed the slogan from fight for your rights to vote for your rights. And so, to begin to wind up, I want to come back to this issue that, you know, people still say that it'll never happen here, why isn't it like France? Actually, it's very much like France today anyway. Things go up and they die down. And there's not the organisations to keep them going at the level it needs to be. We don't make the most of the upturns when they happen. And so I actually want to outline the people who are too young to know and to remind those of us that have even lived through it and people still forget, in the last 10 or so years, but like I could go back to the mid-80s to really dramatise the point, because I was in an occupation around education issues in the mid-80s in Sydney where the students chanted at us, no politics, no politics. We were raided by the police. Nobody would blockade the doors, and the police came straight to the socialists, and I was so black and blue afterwards that I had to go to the swimming pool to try to get back my ability to walk and to move and everything. The whole of the pool would just stare at me because I looked like a victim of, everyone thought I was a victim of domestic abuse. So I was black and blue from top to bottom. That was the consequence, you know, and that was the climate in which we worked. The 1990s have seen an absolute sea change, and I'm not going to go right through the 90s, but let's start with 1998 and the tens of thousands of people who mobilised to defend the Maritime Union of Australia, and we chanted, MUA here to stay, and they're still here. We had 100,000 people on the street in Melbourne on May Day. In the year 2000, we had 250,000 people walked across the Sydney Harbour Bridge for Aboriginal rights. We had 100,000 in Melbourne, 40,000 in Brisbane, 50,000 in Adelaide. 2003, we had 1 million people on the streets in Australia wanting to stop the war. And that was before the war even started. There wasn't the organisations to keep the grassroots campaigning going, and when the war started, we had demoralisation because people said, you can't stop it just through protest. We could have stopped the war if we'd been able to build on that million and turned it into strike action and all the other things that probably would have been possible. We saw the blockade of the World Economic Forum in the year 2000. 2005-2006, we saw the four largest working class mobilisations in Australian history. And again, what it's been turned into is an election campaign for the Labor Party, as I've said. And so, you know, like, that's just the big events. We've had tens of thousands of people out about racism to defend David Hicks, to save the forest, to stop the global warming. Last year, in the bombing of Lebanon, the tens of thousands of people in Sydney, eight months after we'd seen the racist riot in Cronulla, the Lebanese community would have thought never would have come out of their covens again out of fear, and we saw tens of thousands of them on the streets, Arabs, Muslims, non-Arabs, a few tiny numbers of us, but they're standing in solidarity with the confidence to say, we're not going to take it any longer. They're destroying the country of Lebanon and people are going to actually, you know, stand up against the racism that we suffer, not just in the Middle East, but right here in Australia itself. We've seen Aboriginal riots, we've seen protests to support Aboriginal rights against the continuing deaths in custody caused by the racist police force. And so it is not the case that we need more education of the people who matter. Like Sharon said, the people who matter are the people who make the wealth of society, the people who go to work, who actually keep this society going and therefore have the power to bring it to its knees. And that is what is going to be, it is going to need to happen. I'm sure I'm coming close to my end of my time. So I'm going to skip one or two points I had to try to start to come to a conclusion because, you know, I think, you know, when you see the pattern, it's so clear. This isn't just about one government there, some government here, occasionally a protest movement here or there, and, you know, we can just fix a few things up. Actually, whether it's poverty in Africa, whether it's the war, whether it's the abuse of human rights, whether it's the attacks on workers' conditions, whether it's the right to have a trade union, whatever the issue, it's more and more clear to masses of people that these issues all come from the rotten society that we live in, that is a globalised society. And so the capitalist own language brings it home, doesn't it? That we live in a globalised world. And you can see us here tonight with all of us here who want to change the world. And that's what we're going to be talking about over the weekend. And I'll finish by saying that there are no shortcuts. There's no point in people hiding behind the fact that there's not more people in the room, that when we go and we have 100,000, the next week we can't get the 200,000 who would probably come out if the unions would keep building. We have to build an alternative, not just, you know, to capitalism. First of all, we have to build an alternative to the existing political organisation. We have to take our eye off the top of society, except to keep them, you know, our eye on them so that we're protesting when we need to. But we need to take our eye off the parliament and be in the streets, organising in the workplaces, in the campuses, all the kinds of activity that, you know, we've heard about here tonight. Now, because I'll finish with something that some of you might know, the novelist China Miéville, who is a novelist and quite popular with left-wing novels and things. He's also a researcher and he's written a fantastic book about international law. And it's really worth looking at because you don't find many law books that say the law is there to prop up the system of capitalism. It serves the interests of those in power. It serves the interest of continuing to make profits at the expense of the vast majority. And he says to those people who just want to tinker around, to those people who think, oh, you know, it's dreadful what's happening in situations like David Hicks, we need the rule of law, he says the chaos and the bloody world around us is the rule of law. There is no alternative until we begin to tear the whole system down root and branch. And so hopefully people should be beginning to get the idea from the three speeches that we're for bringing it down root and branch, but also that the starting point now is that we actually think another world is possible. And I say, in the words of Arundhati Roy, one of my favourite anti-capitalist writers, not that I share all her politics, which is a fan, she often finds the best words. And she says in her little book, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, she says, another world is not only possible, on a quiet day you can hear her coming.